From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. In the years following World War II, the nation that was then West Germany faced a singular challenge. From the ashes of defeat and the shame of National Socialism, a new society had to be constructed, a new identity found. The self-examination and self-definition that this required is a complex, essential, and largely unexplored dimension of the political resurgence of Germany. My guest today is Robert Moeller, professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. Bob Moeller, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks, George.
Bob, you're writing about how Germans came to compose their imagined community in the wake of World War II, the new sense of identity they had defined. And reading your very fine writing on this, first of all, put me in mind of another country, of Japan, and of the fact that they faced something of the same question, perhaps. And they've made use, as I understand it, of the Allied occupation and the constitution of the Allies, in a sense imposed on Japan, to help them do that. I have a sense, Bob, that that did not happen in Germany, and I suppose my first question would be, why not? I mean, why was the Allied occupation and the American occupation of such little import to this?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was of little import. I would say that it has a kind of very ambivalent impact. Certainly in the immediate post-war period, the Western Allies in the Western zones of occupation have as their most important goals demilitarization, denazification, and democratization. And in some ways, I think that it's arguable that they play an important role in legitimating and helping certain organizations to become established within the Western zones of occupation that become the Federal Republic, that make it possible for the Federal Republic to become a democratic nation. At the same time, I think it's very important to see that there's a tremendous amount of resistance and resentment on the part of many West Germans to Western occupation and to the particular forms of denazification and demilitarization. There's a very widespread sense that the thesis of collective guilt, which is offered by the Western Allies at the end of the war, is completely inappropriate and mistaken. Mm-hmm. And this resistance of the notion of collective guilt goes across the political spectrum.
So the Germans
in the Federal Republic.
Excuse me, the Germans, in a sense, then rejected the notion that they were all collectively guilty of the Nazi period.
Yeah, if you read through, as I've recently had the chance to do, Telford Taylor's account of Nuremberg, what's interesting is that built there also into the indictment is a very, I think, in some ways, sophisticated sense of the ways in which a society allows an institution like National Socialism to come into place, and in which there is a kind of collective responsibility mm-hmm. and accountability for the excesses of this regime. And it seems to me that very quickly at the end of the war, and to some extent beginning already in an internal discussion during the war, there's a distinction between Germans and Nazis.
Right.
A clear sense that there are a handful of individuals who are responsible for the excesses and the crimes of National Socialism, and that in some senses Germans as well are victims of this regime.
Yeah, and I think that this notion of victimization is going to play very strongly in our conversation. Tell me this, Bob, why is popular culture so important as a theme for you to investigate?
I guess I'm interested in the ways in which personal experiences translate into public memory in the 50s, and it seems to me that popular culture plays an important part in this. The novels that people read, the movies that people see, in the work that I've done most recently in looking at collective experiences of expellees from Eastern Europe and German prisoners of war, there are entire genres of popular novels that emerge, particularly in the period, say, 1950 to 1955, which are immensely popular, which have great print runs, which continue to be republished, which also are translated in some cases into movies.
Well, let me ask you a question to see if this is a proper example of what you're talking about. You made me mindful of a series I saw here with English subtitles called Heimat, that was sort of chapter after chapter of a German family's progression through this century, covering the war years as well. But the intriguing thing to me, Bob, I'd love to get your comment on it, was how quotidian and sort of banal everything was. I mean, the war was there and all of that, but it was almost a soap opera in the sense of what the individual in the family went through. Is that an example of the kind of thing that was coming out in the 50s?
Well, this Edgar Wright's I think it ran for 15 hours in part one, and now he's got part two on the 60s, which runs 24, 25 hours, I think is a interesting example of the way in which in the late 70s and 80s, there was, in fact, an attempt to create a kind of politics of daily life, history of daily life account. It seems to me that that's distinct from much of the popular culture of the early 50s, which focuses precisely on moments of catastrophe. So that there's a whole genre of novels about the expulsion from the East, which begin at the moment that the Red Army appears and focuses on catastrophe, chaos, hardship. In the same way, the novels of the war experience, there's a whole set of novels about Stalingrad. There's a whole set of novels about my 7.5, 8.5, 9.5 years under the Red Star in Soviet POW camps.
Let me risk an opinion then, based on what you've said right here. I get the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Bob, that with a popular culture so focused on crises and extraordinary catastrophic events, that there's kind of a culture of victimization perhaps building up here, or at least there's an emphasis on the suffering that Germans underwent. Is there not in this depiction?
Yeah, I think that that's important, and that what it also implies is a way of defining what constitutes the war experience. That in these attempts in popular culture, and I've tried to make the case that it's by no means exclusively in popular culture, that it registers also in public policy debates and in other forms of coming to terms with the past, particularly up until 53-54. There is, I think, an attempt to dissociate National Socialism from the war. The war becomes this kind of natural catastrophe for whom, in some accounts, no one really has responsibility, that washes over everyone, Germans and non-Germans alike, in which the lines between victims and perpetrators become blurred, in which everyone becomes victims, in which Germans become, in a sense, the last victim of the war. What seems to me important about this is creating a history that begins in 1943 at Stalingrad, that begins in the fall or winter of 1944, the winter of 44-45, as the Red Army pushes ever farther eastward. That begins on May 8, 1945, not with capitulation, but with being taken prisoner by the Red Army, and beginning an odyssey that ends 7, 8, 9 years later and takes you first behind the Urals and then finally back home.
You know, in listening to this, Bob, I have a sense that what the Germans were faced with was constructing what we might call a usable past, and that to do it, they were necessarily selective. I mean, they sort of chose to look at the past in a certain way, which obviously means they chose to leave out a certain way of looking at it.
I think that there's a different weighting. There are different forms of the ways in which memory gets written and elevated and commemorated in the 50s. I think it's important to emphasize that the other past, the past in which Germans are perpetrators is by no means forgotten, and there are important instances of this in the early 50s. The whole series of debates around the Treaty for Reparations with Israel for restitution of Jewish victims of the National Socialist crimes who don't end up in Israel. This, to be sure, is very divisive within the West German public, and there are many West Germans who would be just as happy not to pay any reparations to Israel at all. And there are representatives in the German federal parliament who ultimately vote against this. And at the same time, it seems to me important that this past is very explicitly discussed. And in the same sense, other measures for racial, political victims of the regime for compensation of these kinds of victims, in fact, do take place. What's interesting to me is the ways in which those discussions take place largely in the absence of survivors. Survivors aren't called upon to take part in defining solutions to their own problems.
You mean survivors of those particular groups?
Yes, in the same way that German victims are. So that there are interest groups by the early 50s representing war veterans, representing victims of bombed out cities, representing the expellees from the East, who not only have representatives sitting in parliament, but are called upon in their institutional forms to give testimony to the subcommittees that debate the specific measures which are going to address their needs. And the same thing, there is no parallel, it seems to me, for the victims of the racial and political crimes of National Socialism.
It would seem to me that through this process, what effectively took place was, first of all, the identification of a group as, quote, war-damaged. A group composed of orphans, of widows, of returning POWs and so forth. But is it not the case, Bob, that the focus for a number of reasons, I mean, almost the spotlight clearly went to them, and that in a sense it's their collective histories that began to form the core, at least, of this new memory, of this redefinition of the past?
Yes, it seems to me, certainly in the 50s, the public memory of the war that becomes most pervasive is one of German suffering and German recovery. That the past that is to be overcome in the 50s is one of immense destruction and enormous personal suffering, of the severance from Germany of large parts of what had been Germany within its 1937 borders, and of German-speaking and culturally German colonies in other parts of Eastern Europe, this enormous sense of loss, which also carries, I think, a coded message, and often not very coded, of a radical critique of the Potsdam Agreement.
Yes.
The lack of insight on the part of the Allies to see what Stalin really had in mind, and that Germans are now doing penance in some ways for the myopia of the Allies. In its most extreme right-wing political form, this can, of course, take the form of saying, we knew about communism long ago. After all, we were fighting communism. That was central to the self-definition of the Third Reich. Why did you all come to understand this so late?
You mentioned communism, and one of the things I was struck by in reading your writing on this were two things, actually. One is that as all of this is going on internally in Germany, it seems to me that Germany's external role, at least as the Allies are increasingly want it to be, is as a kind of a staunch barrier against communism. The Cold War is very much sort of kind of setting the context in which the West sees Germany. And then also, internally in Germany, for a number of reasons I think you're helping us understand, communism is becoming the bete noire of political life. I mean, very strong.
Yes, I think that the Cold War context is absolutely essential to understanding anything about post-war West German domestic political development, and in some ways to be flip, if the Cold War hadn't happened, the West Germans would have had to invent it. Certainly here also, Korea is vital. Without the Korean conflict, which intensifies immensely the Western Allied desire to have a remilitarized Germany and to have a Germany that's going to be integrated into a Western military security alliance is enormous. So that up until, well, not up until 1950-51, but certainly immediately after the war, this enormous emphasis on Germany as a militaristic society and we have to demilitarize Germany once and for all has to be overcome very quickly.
Exactly. I got lots to talk to you about, Bob, lots more questions. Let me take a moment, though, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Robert Moeller, professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. Robert Moeller is currently a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center, and he was educated at Wesleyan University, Brandeis, and the University of California at Berkeley. Let me ask you this question, Bob, about the outcome of this process as we move through the late 40s into the 50s. First of all, do we get a new German cohesiveness or solidarity by the mid-50s as this, as memory and history are reconstructed along these bases?
The backdrop to the entire process, of course, can't be forgotten, which is this enormous economic recovery by the mid-50s. Many of the problems of integrating this massive overpopulation in the immediate post-war period, literally millions of ethnic Germans who come to West Germany, of confronting what for some contemporary observers in the immediate post-war period is seen a problem that can never be solved, has to do with economic recovery on a massive scale. And this has to do in part with the fact that the German economy, as economic historians have recently discussed, wasn't nearly as completely destroyed as was commonly thought, with the massive influx of foreign capital and also the Marshall Plan. And this is certainly the story which is most frequently told. The kind of conventional wisdom on the post-war period is that the Germans are apolitical after the war, that they can become political once their stomachs are full and the economy is booming, and the economic miracle is the story that dominates the 50s. I don't in any way want to argue or dispute the significance of that. What I do want to say is that another part of this has to do with a kind of definition of a social contract within West Germany, and part of that social contract has to do with accounting for the destruction of the war between people who have suffered enormous loss and people who haven't. For those who have, the compensation is never great enough, and I don't want to suggest that everybody goes smiling into the late 50s. And at the same time, it seems to me that symbolically and at the level of the creation of a political nation, again, borrowing from this image of Benedict Anderson of an imagined community, what's going to create the basis for social solidarity, this construction of a past in which the war is the past and the war is enormously destructive to many Germans is very important.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bob, it occurs to me that in addition to its base in popular culture, questions of gender, and even high state politics, however we want to define it, this is also at root a kind of an issue of the progression of German leadership in the sense that, you know, we begin our story with Konrad Adenauer. We progress through a very dramatic moment where Willy Brandt leads Germany and right to the present with Helmut Kohl leading the country. That, you know, these three men in three different epochs also tell us something about this story. And against that statement, I'd like to ask you specifically about the period where Willy Brandt becomes head of the German state, because it seems to me that that is a singular chapter in the story, and that Brandt, far from being a German soldier or someone who had participated in the war on that basis, had been a resistor, mm-hmm. and had come to power and made no bones about that, and had taken a very strong stance about having Germany address those other parts of the history that some might have felt it hadn't adequately dealt with. What's the impact and the import of that period on this reinvention?
It seems to me it's very important. I mean, I think what for me becomes a kind of singularly significant moment is Brandt's Ostpolitik and treaties with both Warsaw and Moscow in 1970, and the kind of public calling to accountability of West Germans for what atrocities have been caused in Poland and the Soviet Union during the war. I think this is part of a generational shift that can already be seen by the late 50s, when, of course, Brandt is already very politically active. And lines of generation is perhaps not the best way to put it. It's almost age cohorts. It's the movement to a group of people who are educated and come into their political maturity after the war, as opposed to those who do so before 1945. And it seems to me it's reflected across a whole number of arenas. The fact that Germans become more active in the prosecution of Nazi war criminals, that there are trials of SS officers and the commandants of various concentration camps. Certainly the Eichmann trial has a big resonance within West Germany. The fact that there's a new group of historians who write a very different history of National Socialism, which ties the 30s to the 40s, which shows how the move to extermination can be found in the kind of progressive social marginalization of Jews and other so-called asocials in the 1930s, that the war is not such a complete rupture as it had been depicted immediately after 1945. All of these things come together. 68, I think, is also a very important moment, that you have a radical student generation which is asking of its parents, where were you in 1945?
Exactly.
In ways that hadn't been done before.
That's really Germany responding to the times, in a sense. I mean, these are phenomena that are happening in many other places.
Yes, yes, and are carried out against this particular historical background with certainly a terrific passion and in some cases a very brutal confrontation of generations in West Germany. But Brandt, for me, does represent an enormously important moment in this kind of development.
Let me ask you a question, Bob, about perspective. I mean, as an historian, I was struck by the fact, and as a lay reader, welcomed the approach you took of bringing so much of popular culture and everyday life, if you will, into the narrative and into your explanation. Are you, as an historian, generally satisfied with the degree to which this is being done, or dissatisfied?
Oh, yeah, I think it depends on who you read. In a sense, I think that the historical profession has become so enormous that we all now have our little sub-communities, and that's who we read, and that's who we go to conferences with, and that's who we pay the most attention to. And when those sub-communities intersect, we confront each other, I think, altogether too often as visitors from different planets. But certainly it seems to me that the kind of influence of the new social history in this country, the influence of feminist writing, which has dramatically expanded our thinking about what constitutes the political, is happening in many different places. Now, where it seems to me this is less apparent is in attempts to tie together domestic and foreign policy. Foreign policy is, for instance, an arena in which social historians have, for the most part, always felt very ill at ease, and feminists have also not talked about very much. Mm-hmm. And yet it seems that there are real ways in which the whole discussion about the reformulation of the family in the early 1950s is paralleling and echoing the way in which West Germany is becoming part of a family of nations. The debate around what is to be the equal status of women and men is paralleling a discussion of the equality of a reformulated Germany with the nations it was at war with in 1945. And making those connections seems to me something that happens less often.
Bob, to conclude a conversation that I found enjoyable and informative, I must say, I would like to try and ask a question that brings us right to the present day and perhaps even takes a look into tomorrow, if that's not too speculative. And here's my thinking. Here's what occurred to me. that even as Germany's reinvention of herself has matured, it's coming under intense new strains, as you and I sit here practically. I mean, things such as the reunification itself has certainly brought new forces to bear. The, to use a phrase, flawed assimilation of foreigners, of which we see so much evidence, clearly also indicates some strain and problem. And then finally, the new kind of European identity that the European community and NATO and others are compelling Germany to come to grips with. Against all of this, is this search for a usable past continuing? I mean, does the search go on, and is it being informed by or changed by or altered by these kinds of realities in ways that you both depict and feel confident about?
The search for a usable past certainly is going on. If you look at the ways in which now unified Germans are investigating the parallels between what's referred to as the two dictatorships of the 20th century, that kind of return to what in the 50s, of course, was a kind of totalitarianism framework, I find very interesting, and I'm curious to see where it's going to go and what its political implications may be. I think also that what I find interesting is the ways in which, in the absence of the context of the Cold War, a past which was so dominated by the Cold War is going to be revisited. To be more explicit, if you look at the coming year in 1995, there are a whole series of anniversaries that take place across the Eastern Front. It's indicative of where this is going to end up to me that the turning point of the war is now being celebrated in June as D-Day, not Stalingrad, that 1943 was not celebrated in the same way, that the Russians were not invited to D-Day. And as we push farther eastward, it seems to be very significant to begin to think through how, in the absence of this easy, in some ways, framework of the Cold War, where you knew who your enemy was, how that shared past of Germans and Eastern Europeans is going to be worked through. And there I don't have a good prediction of how it will look, but that's what I would like to pay attention to. I think what's going to happen in Eastern Europe, as freed from a kind of stranglehold of a Marxist-Leninist framework, they begin to look at their own past, how the establishment of communist successor regime governments looked in Eastern European countries, what relationship they had with German ethnic populations, and on the other hand, how the Germans rethink this expulsion from the East will be very interesting to see. I mean, we've only begun at D-Day. By the time we get to the Vistula, I think that a lot of history will have been rehearsed and replayed in the coming year.
I think so, too. Robert Mulder, thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Robert Mulder, professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. I am George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.